Now stay tuned for the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for being with us today on another Sunday on The Wren. Our topic today, a little difficult, but hopefully you'll bear with us because it's really important and very interesting. Our guest, Alexandra Metter. She's the deputy Commonwealth attorney in Augusta County. As we discuss the prosecution of sexual abuse and assault with a focus on child abuse. So Ms. Metter joined the Augusta County Commonwealth's attorney office in June 2015, and she primarily specializes in the prosecution of child sex abuse, adult sexual assault, and domestic violence cases. Prior to joining the office, she served as a law clerk for Chief Justice Donald W. Lemons of the Supreme Court of Virginia. Alex is a member of Augusta Stanton Waynesboro Multidisciplinary Task Force for Child Abuse and the Blue Ridge Criminal Justice Board's Juvenile Justice Committee. She provides domestic violence training to local enforcement officers as well. Ms. Metter, thank you so much for being with us to discuss this important topic.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
The first thing that I'm sure you get when you gather with friends you haven't seen in a while, with people that you're being introduced to who ask, well, what do you do? Is what prompted you to focus your career on this field of casework?
Yeah, so I do get that question a lot. And I have a lot of people that say, oh my gosh, I couldn't do that work. And I mean, I appreciate that. Before law school, I was a youth programs director for a grassroots organization called Cheyenne River Youth Project in South Dakota. It's on an Indian reservation. And I worked with kids in direct services for 4 years during that time and really loved that work. I did have a number of children that I worked directly with that had been through various forms of trauma, either sexual abuse, some in homes of domestic violence. And that's true in any area they're going to work, and I encountered it there. And through that work, I really developed a passion for the idea of helping these children. And a lot of times in the area that I was working, there are sort of really strange jurisdictional issues with Indian reservations. And so, and there's a lot of distrust of law enforcement as well, just based off of historical trauma. And so there was just a lot of situations in which children were being abused and that was not going through the legal system and it wasn't being reported because of that distrust. And there were just so much frustration on my end in trying to help these children with the limited amount of sort of knowledge and power that I had in that situation. And I ended up deciding to go to law school. And when I came out of law school, I decided to focus my career on prosecuting crimes against children, but also other vulnerable victims like domestic violence victims. And I also prosecute crimes against the elderly as well.
So you go to JMU as an undergrad, you go to UVA Law School, then you're at the Cheyenne River Sioux Reservation in South Dakota, and you come and do this work at Augusta County. How many of these cases do you work on monthly or annually? Does this particular work allow time for other cases, or is this all you do? Does this keep you overwhelmed in what you do? Give me a concept of how many cases there are in your field, in your area.
Sure. So So we have a number of cases that I get involved in that don't necessarily go through the criminal justice process. We start off with typically an interview at a child advocacy center, and I know we can talk about what that means in a second. But I was able to look up the statistics for this because it's hard. It's actually hard to grasp my brain around how many we do because we do so many. And I found that we average about 100 interviews a year. And so that's 100 interviews in situations in which there's been an allegation of either sexual or physical abuse or neglect against a child. And we are interviewing that child in a friendly, non-leading environment to determine what has happened with them. And so some of those cases are founded and some require action with respect to the Department of Social Services, but might not rise to the criminal level. Others do rise to the criminal level and we do file charges. So it just depends on what's disclosed in the interview. And so that's sort of how it starts. And I would say we have about 100 interviews a year, and a smaller portion of that actually get picked up for criminal prosecution. But to answer your broader question, you could have a person that's exclusively devoted to child sex abuse cases. I am not exclusively devoted to that because I do other types of cases as well. And then we have a few other attorneys in our office that have a little bit less experience than me, but still do an amazing job that pick up some of the other child sex abuse cases. So that it's not just one person doing it. It's not just one person building expertise in that area.
Again, our guest today is Alex Metter, as we talk about sexual abuse, with the focus on child sex abuse and the prosecution of that. She's a deputy Commonwealth attorney over in Augusta County. You will hear anatomical body parts at some point during the hour. Alex, you mentioned statistics. I dug up a couple here, which always amaze me, make me ill. 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys will be sexually abused before they turn 18 years old. Children are most vulnerable between the ages of 7 and 13 to sexual abuse. 90% of child sexual abuse victims know the perpetrator in some way. So I guess that means family, friend, neighbor. And during a 1-year period in the United States, 16% of all youth ages 14 to 17 had been sexually victimized. I got these off U.S. government websites, so take them for what they are. Statistics can always be read in different manners. But it doesn't take much to make those statistics make you want to close your eyes, turn away, get sick, shake your head as that can't possibly be right. But you're with this daily in some manner, correct?
Yes. Yeah, we do take breaks. I'm actually taking a break right now and doing some drug and property cases for a while because of the vicarious trauma of holding all of these stories. But yes, for the last 6 years on a daily basis.
And can you give me what the definition is of child sexual abuse? Are we talking about physical touching only? Because many of us are familiar, even if just by TV crime show stereotype, on adult sexual assault. So can you give us the definition of the other?
Sure. So there's a broader definition of what I would consider child sex abuse now, and then there are also specific crimes that require specific elements to be proven. But the broader definition is basically any sexual act between an adult and a minor. And it can also be a sexual act between two minors in which one exerts power over the other. And there's a whole different way that we handle minors who perpetrate sexual crimes against other minors. We treat them differently than adults for a number of reasons that I can explain. But that's the broadest definition. Now, there are certainly different acts that could be considered grooming and in terms of showing a child pornography maybe different acts of voyeurism, communicating in a sexual manner can be considered in the wider umbrella of child sex abuse. But when it comes to actually prosecuting crime, then you're going into slightly narrower definitions that have specific elements.
So you talk about grooming. Talk mm-hmm. about that for a bit, because I'm disturbed by what that sounds like.
Sure. So grooming is a process in which an offender gradually draws a victim into a sexual relationship, and that's how they maintain the relationship in secrecy. And so there's lots of behaviors that can be grooming. It's always with that end goal that they are going to be able to sexually perpetrate against that child. But, I mean, there can be a lot of behaviors that go with grooming: special attention, outings, gifts. Sometimes it involves isolating the child from other people in certain ways. Definitely filling the child's unmet needs. So we see a lot of grooming centered around a lot of times, like, children that do have, different issues. They might have some neglect in the home, or maybe they just want more attention from a parent, and someone comes in and they're giving them all that attention that they really want. That's part of the grooming process. Sometimes treating a child as if they are older and special can be part of the grooming process. And so it's basically about creating this special relationship with a child in which the child feels loved and valued and needed, and really developing this deep level of trust with that child, sometimes for years and months out from the sexual abuse.
There can't be every person who shows special attention to a younger child under the age of 18 certainly isn't grooming them for child sexual abuse. So how do you differentiate the bad from the good?
As a parent, or
as anyone who has access to witness the behavior of the child or the adult, or I guess the older individual in this case, because you said it's not always, you said sometimes it can be two children, just one with more power. Was that the word you used?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how do you differentiate a negative relationship versus a negative one where one is grooming the other?
Yeah, it's actually, so one of the problems is it's actually really hard to differentiate. There are so many people out there that have really great intentions and just want to be a kind and loving mentor and presence in your child's life. And some of those relationships can be some of the most rich relationships that kids have growing up. But some of those people are predators. And how do you differentiate? Well, it's very difficult to, because it looks almost exactly the same as someone who is is going into your child's life with good intentions. I would say that the biggest way that you can help prevent a child from being sexually abused is to make sure that that child has the tools to understand when somebody has crossed a boundary with them that is not okay, and that they have the people in their life that they trust to go to and talk to about it. So I will say that grooming does eventually cross certain lines when you get into the sexual contact. And so the last stages of grooming are sort of gradually crossing physical boundaries, you know, becoming more touch-oriented, for example, increasingly becoming intimate, increasingly bringing up sort of sexual topics that are inappropriate to discuss with children. And then one of the biggest red flags that I think might be a little bit easier to see externally, or at least if you talk to the child, is if somebody is trying to have that child keep secrets, any type of secrets, like, oh, this is our little secret, or this is our fun game, but you can't tell anyone. Anything that that child cannot tell their friends, their teacher, their parent about, that's a huge red flag. So that's one thing that you can definitely look for and ask about. But the biggest thing that you can do to protect your child or protect any child that you know, this is mostly advice for parents, though, is to make sure that your child knows all of the names of all of their anatomical body parts, the anatomical names, and because it's really important that you don't get confused when they're trying to tell you about something that may have happened. If your child, there was a situation that I knew about where a child had the name Cookie for her vagina. And yes, sorry, we are using that word because we want to normalize using that word. It's good to say the word vagina. It's good to say the word penis, because when we normalize those words, then kids aren't ashamed of saying them. And when they can say them, then they have the ability to communicate what might be happening to them. So she used the word Cookie, and the parents didn't know what she was talking about when she was saying something about her cookie being touched. They actually had no idea for a period of time where the sexual abuse continued, because she didn't know the right name to tell them where they could understand. And so that's really important. And then also empowering your child with bodily autonomy and making decisions about what is okay and is not okay for them in terms of physical interaction with others. So, I go to a really wonderful church, and, you know, I've had a situation where a very good friend of mine had her little toddler and was like, go hug Alex, and she didn't want to. And, you know, the parent was like worried that my feelings would be hurt. So she's like, come on, go hug her. And I said, no, it's okay. And I squatted down to the little 2-year-old and I said, you don't have to hug anyone that you don't want to hug. And that's totally fine with you. So, you know, it's just about making sure that, you know, they understand that they can say no to adults, and that they can go and talk to the parent if anyone has done or said anything that makes them feel uncomfortable. And that's really our best way to prevent child sex abuse from happening in the first place with a particular child, and to prevent something from progressing.
I mean, it's great advice, amazing advice that I'm sure a lot of parents and grandparents and others with small children in their lives should be listening to and hopefully are learning about. Alex Metter, Deputy Commonwealth Attorney in Augusta County, who handles the prosecution of a number of child sexual abuse cases. Let's take a break and we'll come back and continue to talk about this topic. Be right back. And here we are on a Sunday morning. Thank you so much for being with us as we talk with Alex Metter about the prosecution of children's sexual abuse, a difficult topic, and we've already mentioned anatomical body parts. you may hear that again. Be prepared. So, Alex, is there a stereotype of children who are sexually abused? You mentioned children who don't know the names of their proper names of their body parts. But is there something else here that may make them more vulnerable for abuse?
Sure. So, I mean, I would say that there's a number of points of vulnerability, but that no one is necessarily immune. You know, whether you're in any socioeconomic bracket, and any race, any culture, there's child sex abuse everywhere. And so no one is immune from it, but there are certain things. And I think that probably one of the biggest factors is, you know, whether a child has that knowledge to protect themselves, because people who are smart about it, which is most of them, because, you know, as we know, most child sex abuse predators go undetected for a number of years before getting caught, but because they are so crafty about it. But they, you know, they start talking to the child. And if a child is really self-assured and they really clearly state their opinions on things and clearly state their likes and dislikes, then in all likelihood, they're probably not going to be targeted, because they are trying to find children who will go along with this whole secret keeping thing, and who are more compliant and less self-assured. And that doesn't mean that people who have been victims of sexual abuse definitely have all of those traits, because that's not true either. But I'm just trying to sort of give people an idea of different ways in which you can empower your children to reach out for help. Because a lot of people who've been victims of child sexual abuse, a lot of why they didn't reach out for help sooner just came down to, one, not knowing who they could reach out to, and to sometimes not even understanding what's happening to them at all. And so I can think of a case, this is not one of my cases, but a case that I heard about in training a couple of weeks ago, where it was a 10-year-old girl who her father had sex with her for a number of years, and raped her is the appropriate term. And she thought that's what all fathers did with their daughters. She had no idea. She just thought that was something that was normal. It was her father. It was one of the people that she trusted most in the world. So I think that she knew that she didn't like it, but she just thought that was a normal thing. And then when she got into family life classes, they do that segment at school, she learned that it wasn't and disclosed at that time. And so, arming our kids with knowledge, it really helps with protecting them. But in terms of, you know, there really isn't necessarily a particular kid. I do know that sometimes it is easier for offenders to exploit children who are in homes in which they are neglected and in which they are wanting positive adult attention. They will exploit that.
Are there different manners? Are there different issues involved based on age groups or genders?
That's a good question. I don't know if I have a complete answer for it. I mean, I can tell you that, you know, children under five, it's a lot rarer, obviously, for those children to be targeted. And I know that in the majority of those cases, it's an actual family member. And I just think it's an access issue. I can't really tell you specifically, what different predators use, you know, to target female children versus male children. I mean, there's a case in which there was a grooming for a number of years, and the male predator used with a male child his love of fixing up old cars. And that's something that they would do together. And the child absolutely loved it and wanted to be able to continue to do that activity. And when the sexual abuse started, he continued to go because that was something that he really loved doing, was working on those cars. And so, you know, that's a particular case. But I can think of, like, you know, what in the different cases that I have in my head that I've done, what different predators have used, but I haven't really done a scale out where I've looked at, you know, this is specific to this group or that's specific to that group.
Okay. So you mentioned earlier the Advocacy Center, which I learned in preparing for the show has to do with once a case is being, I guess, the information is being gathered and the Advocacy Center is being used. So talk about the different methods of reporting and gathering and methods of disclosure from the child.
Mm-hmm. So, I guess, well, a case would start when somebody reports something, right? So a lot of times it'll be reports, anonymous reports, that will go to the Department of Social Services, actually, through their child abuse hotline. And then there's a report that gets generated from that, just with the basic information about whatever is being reported and about some information about the child and the potential offender. And then that is sent out to our multidisciplinary task force, which includes the prosecutor and the law enforcement agency, as well as our child advocacy center. And so we get those reports, and then there's a determination as to whether or not we should have that child engage in a forensic interview at the child advocacy center. And so child advocacy center, there are a number of child advocacy centers across the state. I work with the Valley Children's Advocacy Center, which is an awesome center. Love them. And but here in Charlottesville, I believe it's the Foothills Child Advocacy Center, which I've also heard really good things about. And that's a neutral place where all of the multidisciplinary task force members can come together, and a child can be interviewed in a very child-friendly environment and a child-friendly sort of room where there's a camera, and the multidisciplinary task force sits in a different room and watches it in live time. And actually, during COVID, they've been able to find a way for us to log in remotely just to keep everyone safe. But during normal times, we're all in the same room watching it live. And the forensic interviewer is somebody who's specifically trained to interview children about things that have happened to them. And there is a certification process involved in that that's very rigorous. And they are trained to ask questions in a non-leading way so that we can really get at what actually happened, not planting any ideas in their heads, and get all of the information we need to help that child. And potentially, if they've disclosed something that's a criminal act that happened against them, then we start the criminal investigation from there.
So how do you talk to a child about what's happened without planting ideas in their head?
Mm-hmm. Well, so I'm not a forensic interviewer, although I actually went through the training and got the certification, but I don't ever do the interviewing myself because I'll be prosecuting the case if it ends up going to trial. But, I mean, there are a number of techniques that you use to make sure that you're not giving them any information to sort of go with. But I mean, basically, you start off by just sort of introducing yourself. This is how a forensic interview goes. So, you know, there's the introductions, and then they actually just get to know each other, the interviewer and the child, and they build rapport with each other. And then the interviewer does a number of things to try to gauge sort of where that child is at developmentally so that we know if they're going to be able to answer certain types of questions or if certain types of questions would be confusing to them. So we have like an age chart that we're always referring back to because, you know, at different ages, you develop the ability to be able to say, for example, like when something happened. You know, a very young child is not going to be able to tell you when something happened. They just don't have that developmental ability to be able to do it that yet. And so, and then there are different tricks to sort of be able to try to figure out around when something might have happened, if they remember like a birthday party or, you know, something like that, that was close by. But, so they ask, you know, a number of these questions. They ask them questions about, asking them to describe, you know, how their day started and tell all the way through to see how their narrative ability is and can they tell stories, in sequence or do they jump around, just so that we have sort of a baseline of what we're working with to understand how they're going to be able to relate anything that may have happened to them. And then we often ask them if they know why they're there, because sometimes information has been given to them about, oh, you're going to go, you know, you disclosed this to, you know, your teacher, so you're going to go and tell these people about what happened, so they already know, and so then they can go in to telling it. But it's a lot of open-ended questions, and asking for more details where appropriate, essentially not asking like yes or no questions, because then you've led to that answer. The content of what is being said is in the question, not in the answer.
So you mentioned disclosure, who they might have disclosed the story to. By the way, our guest today, Alex Metter, she's the deputy Commonwealth attorney in Augusta County. She specializes in the prosecution of child sexual abuse cases and adult sexual assault. And we're talking about child sexual abuse cases today. We've already mentioned anatomical body parts, and the words may come up again. So who is most likely to notice and report these cases that puts the child at the advocacy center?
Mm-hmm. So, and I want to sort of backtrack a little bit, because I actually only discuss one way that cases come to us, because sometimes also people report directly to law enforcement. So I discussed, sometimes there's that hotline to DSS that a lot of people call, and then other times they report directly to law enforcement are the two main ways that we get cases. But the people that would be likely to notice, and I would say that a lot of people aren't necessarily likely to notice that a child is being sexually abused. Most of the time, it's because that child discloses that something happened to them. So because, you know, child abuse happens in secret, it happens with no other people in the room, and it doesn't have a lot of warning signs that you can differentiate from a lot of other things. I mean, there can be things that you might notice, a very strong behavior change in a child, but a strong behavior change in a child could be attributable to a number of different factors probably. And so it's not like physical abuse where you see a bunch of bruises on a child and you're like, oh my gosh, this child is being abused, I need to report this. So most of the time it's because a child has disclosed something to you. And so we get a lot of reports from teachers or guidance counselors where a child has often more times told a friend, and then that friend has gone to the adult, and then the adult then goes and talks to the child that disclosed to the friend and then may have disclosed to that trusted adult, which is often maybe somebody in the school system. But we get reports from parents because the child has disclosed to them. And sometimes it's from what we call the non-offending parent. If there is another parent that is the offender, they may go to the police often. At times if a child has disclosed that their other parent is sexually abusing them. And then sometimes when they tell their friends will tell their parents, and then those parents will report to police or to social services.
So, Alex, what do you do when suspicions or disclosures don't turn out to be anything?
Mm-hmm. Well, so I guess maybe I'd like to give an example on this one so people can know exactly what we're talking about when we say they don't turn out to be anything. I had a case a number of years ago where there had been a report that a child was saying that her babysitter was touching her monkey and it hurt. And monkey was obviously a euphemism for vagina, a very strange one, but yet that's what she called it. And so that's a pretty alarming disclosure that their babysitter is touching the vagina and that it hurts. And so we decided to do a forensic interview with that child. And when we had the description, she described some sort of ointment being put on her vaginal region. And then we did a number of interviews and discovered that, in fact, the babysitter was a female teenage babysitter, approximately 15 years old, and that the parent had given instructions because the child had an infection, and so there was nothing sexual or inappropriate happening, and then we just closed the case. And in some situations in which a child discloses certain things that might be happening, but there may not be any criminal aspects happening, we are able to connect them with various services that might be helpful in terms of counseling, because the Child Advocacy Center does have a full-time counselor that can work for free with any child that has been interviewed at the center. It's a really great resource. And so we do refer a lot of children to counseling as well. And so, yeah, we just, there's a number of different things that happen, but there are a number in which, nothing has happened, and that's great. And that's the real value and beauty of being able to do this at the Child Advocacy Center, because it's a totally non-traumatizing environment, and the child does not go away from that having had a negative experience in telling their story.
Alex Metter with us today talking about prosecution of sexual abuse cases among children over in Augusta County. So let's take a break and we'll be right back. Thank you for being here today. Sunday morning wake up call. We're talking about a challenging topic, but we're learning a lot from Alex Metter today. So Alex, I'm assuming that there's an after effect, especially to the child, from telling this story once, especially when it's a family member who's the offender, is accused and punished. Can you tell us more about that, please?
Sure. So I think, backing up a little, I think a lot of people wonder, why does a child not immediately disclose when abuse is happening? And I already sort of addressed one reason earlier, which is that sometimes they don't actually understand that something that's not normal or negative is happening to them, even if they feel instinctually that it's not, because they don't have the knowledge to know that. And there's a lot of other reasons why a child might be reluctant to disclose, and that is because of what can happen after and what they anticipate might happen after they disclose. So if the offender is a family member, then the child is really in a difficult position. And if it's if the offender is a parent, then they're in an almost impossible position, because they know that when they disclose, that that's going to completely upend and potentially destroy the family unit. And, of course, the destruction already happened when the offender abused the child, but a lot of the children take this on themselves and think that they are going to be the ones to blame, and that they're going to be blamed by other family members. A lot of offenders tell children about the consequences of disclosure, that they're going to be blamed, that they're going to get in trouble, that and then some of the offenders who are parents will say, if you tell, they're going to send me to jail and you'll never see me again. And the child feels conflicted about that because it's their parent. And they want the abuse to stop, but that doesn't mean that they don't actually still care about their father or their mother. And so they are really in an extremely difficult position when they're trying to decide whether to disclose. And, of course, they're not even really trying to decide whether to disclose until they actually know that what's happening to them is wrong. And then once they understand that, they're weighing all of these difficult things in their head. Sometimes when it's a step parent, there's a financial aspect. If that step parent is the financial provider for the household, they think, if I tell, we're going to be out on the street. And because, if mommy doesn't have a job or whatever the case may be, they think we need that income. And that's more of a thought process for some of the older children. So they really have a lot weighing on them, and so it's really no wonder that the disclosure rates are actually quite low for child sexual abuse.
Just to go back to some of the statistics and make people think about this, I read earlier 1 in 4 girls will be sexually abused before they turn 18. So go to work and count the number of women in your office and think that 1 in 4 has been sexually abused before they turned 18. And however many people you have, however many women are in your family, and 1 in 4 was probably abused sexually before she turned 18. And we're not talking about what happens after 18. I just find that number, it's almost desensitizing because it's so hard to grasp.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a huge amount. And really, I mean, I know, we all know somebody who's been sexually abused. We just maybe don't know who they are. and part of that is because only 38% of child sex abuse victims disclose the fact that they have been sexually abused. And some people who've been sexually abused never tell another living soul their entire life. So one thing that I don't want to alarm people, but there was a study done, this is way back in 2000, so I know this is 20 years ago, but I still think it's a relevant study. They interviewed in the Federal Bureau of Prisons, they interviewed people who were incarcerated on child pornography charges. So these are non-contact offenses. These are offenses in which they possess child pornography, and they interviewed these people to find out if they had ever had contact or sexually abused a child actually in person themselves. And they found that 76% of people serving time in federal prison for child pornography had a victim. And not only one victim, but the average number of victims that those predators had was approximately 30 children. And all of those, they said, were not law enforcement reported. So It's a huge problem, and the vast majority of children do not disclose for some of the reasons that I mentioned, but there's also actually more. I mean, we could do a whole podcast on all the reasons why a child might not disclose child sex abuse. But it really is a vast problem, and one of the ways that we try to tackle it is through the prosecution of child pornography charges as well, because we know that there's a huge overlap of people who consume child pornography and possess child pornography and people who offend against children. And so when we get one of those predators, we're taking them off the streets and so that they can't offend against live children, which they probably already are doing. And if not, already doing it, most likely would do in the future. So,
well, when you take one of these, we're talking about the fairly low percentage of underage child sexual assaults that make it, that are disclosed, and then I'm assuming even come to court. Does that have anything to do with the number of times that the story would have to be retold? Because who are you telling? I mean, I just think of watching a police show where you have to tell the officer, you have to tell the lawyer, you have to tell it in court. And that's just three. And you know that there's many, 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 many more times.
Right. I mean, I don't know if that would be a consideration that the child is thinking about ahead of time. I think they're thinking more of some of the immediate consequences to their family and the immediate impact on them for telling. But certainly that's an issue.
How about for you? How about for you? Once you have them in front of you, is it an issue for you?
Mm-hmm. Well, so that's an issue that the child advocacy centers were actually created to address, because it can be deeply traumatizing for a child to retell their story multiple times. And unfortunately, we can't prevent them from retelling it more than once, but we can prevent them from telling it a bunch of times. So before the child advocacy centers existed, a child would initially disclose to whoever the citizen is that they disclose to, who then tells the police. Then they might have to tell the law enforcement officer. Then they might have to tell the child protective services person, and then they might have to tell the victim witness, and then the prosecutor, and then they would have to testify to it a number of times. Now, with the Child Advocacy Center, we're all in one place. They tell their story once to the officials, and that is recorded. And often with those recordings, sometimes we can the defense attorneys are able to see the strength of the case, and that fosters negotiations that might prevent the child from having to testify at all. And then if they do have to testify, then sometimes there's a preliminary hearing and then a trial. But you go from having to tell your story 10 plus times, which is deeply traumatizing, to now telling your story, maybe three or four times total, which really reduces the impact of that trauma. So child advocacy centers are wonderful and really help the child along in the process in the criminal justice system.
Again, Alex Metter here, Deputy Commonwealth Attorney in Augusta County, as we're talking about the challenging topic of child sexual abuse and prosecution. So let's talk about prosecution. You've got a case that I saw was Augusta County, Joey Dean Lambert Sr. exposed himself, touched a girl under the age of 10. He blamed alcoholism, but he had previously raped a 15-year-old, and he sold drugs outside of high school. You said he was high risk to reoffend, and he was given 15-year sentence. And I read that in a news article, and I thought, that doesn't seem like a high risk, a high sentence for a high risk reoffender.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we tried that case to a jury, and the jury heard all of the evidence, and I fought to get the prior rape in, and there's a specific statute that allows that in child sex abuse cases, and we did get that before the jury, so they were aware of his prior rape conviction, which was a number of years ago, and did involve a different age victim. But we really fought very hard for that. The maximum sentence that he could get was 30 years. That's what I asked for. The jury came back with a sentence of 15. And I think there's a number of factors that juries can have in their heads when they're trying to determine what an appropriate sentence is. I do know that in that case, they did have the information that on his prior rape, he had gotten 8 years. And I remember the defense attorney making an argument that the facts of this particular case, which was touching over the clothes and exposure, were not as severe as a penetrative event such as rape. I know that that was one of the arguments. I know that another one of the main arguments was that this person does have alcoholism and appears to only offend when he is engaged in, basically drinking. And so I believed that a higher sentence was appropriate. We argued very strongly for that, but the jury, considered all of the evidence and they have a really tough job in trying to weigh and balance everything, came back with a 15-year sentence. He is a much older gentleman, and so I do think that they probably thought that was pretty close to a life sentence for him, but that's what they came up with.
You've also worked with internet solicitation of children's crimes, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do.
Can you talk about that?
Sure. There are a number of different ways that children can be offended against on the internet. And that in and of itself could also be an entire segment. But the cases that I see most often that I do in my jurisdiction are cases in which a offender reaches out to a child. Sometimes they know them in real life. A lot of times they don't. They're reaching out to them on social media, apps, different internet platforms, and developing a rapport with them through messaging. And then those messages become sexual in nature, and they're sexually soliciting that child through the internet. Sometimes they send nude photographs. Other times they try to get the child to send nude photographs to them. And then a lot of times they try to set up a way to meet that child in person in order to engage in sexual conduct. And with the people that I've prosecuted, it's really clear that they understand that the child is the age that they are. Often in the cases that I've prosecuted, the child has been approximately anywhere from 13 to 15 is what I'm mostly seeing in the internet solicitation realm. We prosecuted a number of cases like that. We've also had some stings that we've done through the Augusta County Sheriff's Office. We have a number of investigators that are ICAC trained, Internet Crimes Against Children organization trained in how to do a sting in which they essentially set up a profile as a teen boy or a teen girl. And there is no entrapment here. They just, they don't entice anyone to do anything that somebody wouldn't otherwise. In fact, when a predator starts messaging them, they make it really clear from the very beginning, I am 14 years old and I go to high school, and they talk about their mom and this and that. And they make it so clear that their undercover personality is a child. And then they just let the offender take it from there, and then we arrest that offender for sexually soliciting someone that they believed to be a juvenile.
Yeah, one of the cases that I found that you had done was Tyler Murray from Dunn, North Carolina, posted an online ad seeking a mistress and mentioning age not being a problem. And then he had an online conversation undercover officer. He believed to be a 14-year-old teen girl for several weeks before agreeing to meet. And that's when he was arrested.
Yes. Sorry. I do so many of these cases. I do know the one you're talking about. I don't know if I remember a lot more details than that. but yes, you know, we do a number of online things in which our guys do just a great job of just sort of letting the offender offend. And luckily, it is a police officer instead of a child, and we really honestly have no idea how many children that they may have already offended against. So,
Alex, we have about 1 minute left. What happens? What do you feel like when you'd like to bring charges but cannot?
I'd like to bring charges but cannot. Well, I mean, I think it's a deeply frustrating feeling, that's for sure. I would say it's the minority of the cases that we decide not to bring are ones in which we believe that there has been criminal conduct, but for a number of different reasons, we might not be able to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt in court. And so in those situations, we're trying to really expand the investigation to encompass anything and everything we can to see if the case is viable. And if it's not, then we are doing everything we can to make sure that anyone implicated in a potential disclosure is safe. And making sure that especially that whatever children are involved have the resources that they can, that we can get them.
Our guest today, Alex Metter, is the Deputy Commonwealth Attorney for Augusta County. Alex, thank you so much for being here today and enlightening us all and sharing what you do.
Sure. It was such a pleasure, and I hope it can be helpful to some people.
I'm sure it will be. All right, folks. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.